made a name for himself. He's been on every record-breaking show in the Regal Theater in the last 2 years. Ladies and gentlemen, star.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. We're going to start today our new series coming up every month here on The Mark Steiner Show called Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. It was actually the beginning with brainchild of Dr. Lester Spence, our Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a Detroit native. Lester, good to have you in the studio.
It's good to be here. This is awesome.
Hosting this hour. We're about to have a conversation with Isabel Wilkerson, of course, who wrote Warmth of the Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration, will be our first conversation in this part of this program. And let me just wax forth a minute and then turn over to Lester to explain why he came up with the idea. And for us, when you look at Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, over 2,800 miles separate these cities from one another. Baltimore's right in the middle of the eastern seaboard. Oakland lies in almost the same position across the country on the Pacific Ocean. In the heart of the Midwest sits Detroit, on the largest body of fresh water on the planet. Founded in 1792, Baltimore is where Frederick Douglass made his way to freedom, which he did so yesterday, as a matter of fact, that was the anniversary of that, where the National Anthem was written in 1812, and studying its history, our history here, is almost like looking at that of the United States. Detroit, on the other hand, helps us study the rise and fall of the 20th century. It's a former auto empire. Its freeways, roadways, dot every square mile of the industrial world. And in some ways, studying Oakland is like studying a snapshot of the future. Elected Jean Kwan, the first and only Asian-American woman mayor. It's an open-air mall in Oakland. You're bound to hear dozens of languages being spoken. A multiracial city with not one community being in the majority. Yet these cities share enough to be recognized as sisters. And why? Because they're populated by men and women who lived and died there, who grew up there, who are living through the change of the world there, that were affected by the Great Migration that Isabel Wilkerson wrote about. You know, all three lie on major waterways. All three have long histories of working-class politics. All three were at one point or another homes of some of the biggest manufacturing in the world. And their story is the story of the deindustrialization of this society and of the power of race and class as a determining factor in America. These are powerful stories, and we can bring them all together here. So welcome to Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, the future of the American city and the nation. And before we turn to Isabel Wilkerson, who's online now, Lester, you want to?
Yeah, first, this is exciting project. This is an exciting project to be a part of. So when I was on the other side of tenure, you know, I would come on the show often and we'd talk about the day's events. But then when I got on the right side of tenure, so to speak, I started to think about ways that we could tell stories that tied the various themes we talked about when I would visit, but would tell kind of a longer narrative. And in as much as I've been interested in kind of racial politics, black politics, and urban politics, and the production and reproduction of inequality within those areas, I thought it'd be cool to basically tell a story, to use a story of the Rust Belt as focused in three cities, even though in some ways Oakland's an outlier, in order to kind of figure out where we've been and where we're supposed to go and then how do we get there from here, right? So when we sat down and talked about it, there were so many different directions where we could either talk about all three cities as part of a piece, where we could juxtapose two cities against one. For example, Baltimore and Detroit are kind of old school and they're both kind of monoracial, whereas the Oakland is multiracial. You know, there are all types of things we can do with this. So I thought that this would be an excellent project, an excellent multimedia project to kind of start off the latter half of my career.
So welcome to Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. I'll come right back here with Isabel Wilkerson.
I do mind dying.
John Lee Carter. Please, Mr. Foreman. Lester Spence and I welcome Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, the first African-American woman to win a Pulitzer Prize in the history of American journalism. And welcome back to the program, Isabel Wilkerson. It's been a while. Pleasure to have you with us. Thank you.
Oh, great to be here.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
So I was going through your book again last night and early this morning, and looking at the parts, I first of all jumped in to see what you said about the migrations towards cities like Oakland. So I wonder if we could start there on the West Coast. You start off the migration from Monroe, Louisiana, to Oakland, and talk about how these migrations occurred to these three great cities and how different they were.
Well, I'm intrigued by the combining of these three cities, because these three cities really represent a kind of working class, heartfelt, people of the earth, immigrant and southern culture combined. And I think that they also represent sort of the three points, east, Midwest and West, so it's quite fascinating to see the combination of these three cities. There also are some similarities or some commonalities that have to do with the kind of people that came out of those cities, either grew up in those cities or part of the migration, who ended up going on to make great contributions to our country and to our culture. But to get to your question about Oakland in particular, to start out with, Oakland is a place that drew, you know, hundreds of thousands of African Americans from one part of the South in particular. In fact, this migration, it's a beautiful combination of these three cities, because each of these cities drew from different parts of the South during the Great Migration. So that people who came to Baltimore, of course, there were many people who were in Baltimore who already had been in Maryland, because it was a state that had enslavement, and so there are people who had long been there. But then it also attracted people from the eastern seaboard part of the South. So people from Baltimore attracted people from Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. And Detroit, however, being where it was in the Midwest, attracted people from Tennessee and Alabama and parts of Mississippi. And then Oakland attracted people from Louisiana and Texas, who went to the West Coast, because that was the stream of migration. So this migration that you're speaking about was beautifully predictable, and it affected the culture of the cities that we're speaking of. So each city has its working class roots, but also slightly different based upon the places that the people who arrived came from.
Now, I was wondering, this is Lester Spence, as a side note, thank you so much for your book. To use academic language, you put your foot in it. I mean, that book was really—it was awesome. It was awesome. You're right to focus on the different geographies, like where the immigrants came from. What were they going to? What were the type of what were the different economic factors, to the extent there were economic differences in where, for example, people worked when they went to these places? What were they?
Yes, I see. So the things that drew them, first of all, where they were coming from affected what they would be hoping for. So if they were coming from the tobacco fields of North Carolina and Virginia, they were looking to escape the hard conditions of that kind of work. And so they were coming to these cities, as you'd indicated before. They have in common the fact that they were all on the water. There was shipbuilding involved in both Baltimore and Oakland. There were, you know, steel mills in Baltimore, which attracted many people from the tobacco farms of Virginia, North Carolina, and so on. So they would be looking for that. People who went to Detroit were coming from, as I said, you know, the parts of the South, and they were looking to escape often cotton picking or the kinds of work that they were limited to as domestics in the South. And so they were attracted to Detroit, where they could work in the auto industry, which what Detroit is obviously known for. And then those who went to Oakland had the longest route, the longest journey to take of really almost anybody who would be leaving one part of the country for another. And they were leaving the the sawmills and the sugar plantations, and again, the domestic work that they were limited to work in the shipbuilding, the shipyards, and the associated work that could come from that, particularly during the wars. The World War II attracted many of these people looking for multiple things. I must emphasize, though, that these people were not just leaving only for the jobs. The jobs were a way out. They were an opportunity to get freedom. But this migration was in some ways a defection from a caste system that ruled the lives of all of these people wherever they happened to be in the South. And these people were in some ways seeking political asylum within the borders of their own country. They were leaving a region where it was against the law, for example, in Alabama, for a black person and a white person to play checkers together. They were leaving a world where, in North Carolina, for example, there was a black Bible and a white Bible just to swear to tell the truth on in court. So, and then also all in all of these places, this rigid caste system was so so rigidly enforced that there actually was a lynching every 4 days somewhere in the South in order to maintain this hierarchy that these people were fleeing. So they were fleeing to be free, and freedom meant Baltimore, freedom meant Detroit, freedom meant Oakland, and all these other cities that attracted them.
I'm going to read this one piece you had in your book because I just think it's really apropos to what you were just saying. It's a quote from Richard Wright's Black Boy that you'd written in front of one of your chapters that really, I think, says it. And let's talk about this after I read this. Should I have come here? But going back was impossible. When my eyes turned, they saw stricken, frightened black faces trying vainly to cope with a civilization that they did not understand. I felt lonely. I had fled one insecurity and embraced another. That I'm glad you picked that says so much, Isabel, about what faced people when they got to the North, got to these places in the West and the North. And I'm wondering how you think, in looking at these three cities, how that those migrations transformed those cities and transformed the people in them.
Yes, absolutely. First, I must say that you're reading those passages from Richard Wright, which are so heartrending and so incisive. And today actually happens to be his birthday.
That's right.
amazing to be talking about this on the day that he was born. These three cities were, in my view, reshaped by this infusion of people who were bringing with them not just their hopes, their dreams, their wishes, and their desire to work hard because all that they had known was work back from where they were from, but they also were bringing with them the culture that had sustained them throughout the generations of bearing up under this caste system that I described, first as enslavement and then under Jim Crow. And so these people were bringing with them the music and the ways of speaking and the faith and the food and all the things that had sustained them throughout the the hard years of living in this caste system. And they literally changed the faith of the cities that they arrived in. And I think that if you want to get to some of the people, we can talk about that.
Yes.
As well, but on the whole, they reshaped these cities. Also, they as you speaking to that quote from Richard Wright, they found that while they had been seeking freedom and they found a measure of it, they also were walking into a headwind of resistance because they were actually now in competition with people who had arrived from other places in the world. Each of these cities is also unique in that they are extremely they're multicultural in that they drew people from working class people from all over the world. Of course, we know about Oakland that has a tremendous Asian population and had the first Asian American woman mayor. But of course, Detroit and Baltimore attracted a lot of people from Eastern and Southern Europe. And all these people were arriving in these cities at around the same time, all really wanting the same thing, all having left all that they knew from where they were from, leaving, mother, father, sisters, brothers, the land that they had known, whether Southern Europe or whether South Carolina, wherever it might have been, and taking this great leap of faith into the unknown in these places such as Baltimore, Oakland, and Detroit. And they found themselves, in some ways, put into an artificial competition by the industrialists that had drawn all of them. And so there were things that African-Americans who were coming in this migration were not permitted to do. They were not permitted to join the unions in many cases. There often were auxiliary unions that they were forced to be in where they did not get the same advantages or the same treatment or options that the immigrants might have been getting. And so they ran into a headwind of resistance and many, many obstacles. They also found it very difficult to find housing in these places. So it was difficult for them they were not making the same money. They were not being paid the same amount as the immigrants that were arriving. That is a fact. And they were finding that where they were living, the rents were much higher because they were limited as to where they could live because they did not fit into the category of whiteness, meaning that they could only live in the places in the redlined district. And so there was a tremendous competition, so that meant that there was higher rent or more overcrowded conditions. So that quote from Richard Wright is really, truly representative of what they found.
Isabel, thanks for bringing up a couple of things. First, when you talk about the South, what you're really talking about is an authoritarian regime. I just came back from the American Political Science Association, our annual conference, and there's a sister, Melissa Noble. She's at MIT, and she's actually a comparativist, but she's studying the South as if it were kind of a separate country, an authoritarian country.
But I would agree. It was totalitarian.
Yes, it was. But the other thing is the idea of culture, right? I mean, so in all three places, if you were to meet people from those cities, even though all of them are northern cities, they all still have the populations. Many of the people in them still have southern accents.
Oh, absolutely! You can find a southern accent. You can find pig ears. You can find You can find anything you're looking for.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we ate chitlins just like everybody else in it. Well, I didn't. I'm not really black that way. But we ate chitlins just like everybody else did. But the idea of resistance kind of brings to mind a question about kind of institutionalization and what type of institutions did black people create in those spaces to deal with that resistance and then also to create space for themselves.
Well, first of all, they created some of the biggest mega churches. You know, we hear about the mega churches now, but in some of these places, when you think of like Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York, for example, or the huge churches in Chicago, the huge churches in Detroit, one of the things that they did was they created home places for themselves to practice their faith. Those places often became the points for political rallying. And for organizing in that way, and also just for the comfort of being around people like themselves, building colonies, you might say, in the new world where they happen to be. They also, you know, also such organizations as the National Urban League actually grew as a result, as a response to the massive arrivals of African Americans from the South into these great cities of the North, the Midwest, and West. And so that, you know, we're still living with many of the manifestations and organizations and institutions that grew out of this migration.
Well, go ahead, listen.
You go ahead, Mark.
I'm curious, you know, since you finished this incredible, massive work, The Warmth of Other Suns, and looking at these three cities, what is what you've written about, let's take these three cities again, and what came out of your book, these marvelous stories of individuals, what does it say for the 21st century? What does it say for where we're going because of where we've come from?
That is such a great question. I mean, I find that just thinking about this migration often, first of all, this migration was not a move. You know, a lot of people look at what's called the reverse migration or return migration, and what does that mean? Some people are returning to, say, Charlotte, or they're returning to Houston, wherever they might be going. This migration was really singular in American history because this is the only time in our country's history that the lowest caste people actually indicated that they had choices and were willing to move, actually uproot themselves in order to pursue them. And African Americans are the only group in this country, the only people in this country who had to leave the land of their birth and to go to places far, far away just to be recognized as the citizens that they had always been. And so I find a tremendous amount of inspiration from the fact that these individual people, this migration had no leader. No, we've just come out of the, you know, a week-long commemoration of the March on Washington, and, you know, there's a lot of questioning about black leadership and what should black leadership be doing and who actually, you know, who are the black leaders. And I think that when we look back at this migration, we can find that this was a turning point in American history. 6 million people uprooting themselves and defecting from a caste system, and ultimately by their actions changing the region that they had been forced to flee, ultimately. And after this was the advance guard of the civil rights movement, putting so much pressure on this country to pay attention to what it had not been paying attention to before. And so this gives you a lot of hope and a sense of faith and belief in the power of the individual to not look to leaders to solve the problems. In fact, the leaders of African American life in that era discouraged the people from leaving, outwardly discouraged the people from going, and yet they left anyway. And by leaving, it's actually an indication of the wisdom of the people, the wisdom of the people. And I believe that there's wisdom in people today. These are people who now have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren who have it within themselves to figure out what is best for themselves and their families and not to be looking to outsiders for the answers all the time.
Now, one question I have about question I was trying to formulate. Baltimore and Detroit had relatively large black populations when migrants came from the South, whereas I don't think Oakland did necessarily. What type of tensions were created when black people moved from into places that already had black people, and in some cases black people who didn't even have a history of enslavement at all? What type of tensions did create?
Absolutely, yes. So when the migration began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the time it was over, half were living all over the rest of the country. So it was almost a redistribution of a good portion of an entire people. When they arrived in cities that, you know, in the cities that would have had the largest African American population, which would still have been quite small when you think about it. They were meeting up with moving into neighborhoods where the people had been there for some time and had grown accustomed to and figured out a way to live as a very small minority wherever they happened to be, whether it was Detroit or Chicago or New York or Baltimore, wherever it might have been. And when these people from the South arrived, there were tensions between those African Americans who had been there before and those who were arriving, because those who were arriving were coming in such large numbers that they kind of were overwhelming this much smaller population that had been there before. Those were called the settlers, the old settlers who had been there before. And the old settlers were often quite resistant to and resentful of the arrival of these people because they didn't know what impact this was going to have. They already had this tenuous standing in the communities where they happen to have been. There were some interesting studies conducted by Charles Johnson, the famous sociologist who did some work in San Francisco about the resistance from the African Americans who were already there. They were fearful about what effect this would have on their already tenuous standing there in these cities. They were worried because the people were coming often straight from the field or from these small rural towns where they had so little money that they didn't have the clothing, they didn't fit in with the city sophisticates of these places where they were going, and there was this fear that having too many African Americans coming in would lower the wages of those who were there and make them a more visible threat to the pre-existing order of the cities that they were arriving in. So some of the most extreme resistance actually came from other African Americans who were there already.
You know, that actually brings to mind kind of the tensions that that we hear about now between black populations and Latino populations, in some cases Asian populations, moving into these cities.
Yes, you're right. In fact, it's sort of an immigrant. It's sort of human nature to feel resistance and resentment when you yourself do not feel secure. And so all of this is growing out of insecurity. So the resistance that they got from, say, the immigrants from Southern or in Eastern Europe who also came to Detroit and Baltimore, for example, were the same level of insecurity and economic threat. Because wherever Southern African-Americans were arriving, remember that many of these people had not been paid for their hard labor where they were from. Many of them were working for the right to live on the land that they were farming. They were sharecroppers and not even being paid for what hard work they were doing. So when they arrived in these big cities, they were willing to take almost anything. Their arrival in all these places put a tremendous economic pressure on everyone who was also working class where they happened to be, because they were fearful that they would drive down the wages, which is exactly the same thing that there's fear of with immigrants often coming, Latino immigrants coming to the cities, fearing what's going to happen because they're willing to take any kind of work. What people often don't realize is that wherever immigration actually occurs, it actually is an indication of the desirability of a place, of the economic hopefulness that exists within those outside of it who feel that this can help them fulfill their dreams.
First of all, I want to thank you, Isabel Wilkerson, for once again joining us, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. It's always a pleasure to have you and helping us launch this first episode of Baltimore, Oakland, Detroit here on The Mark Steiner Show. Thank you so much, Isabel.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Great having you with us. We're going to take a very brief break. Lester Spence and I will be back as we look at the history of these three cities and how they came to the place where they are before we turn to talking to the activists in those communities. We go out now with Willie G. from Detroit. Loving me is like money in the bank.
Loving me, baby, is just like money in the bank. You know you can't lose, and this I'm gonna prove. So if you'll just trust in me, baby, you will see that love in me is just like money.
Floaters didn't get to the lyrics.
Yeah, you wanted to
float on.
Yeah, so the Floaters is not just a 1970 Detroit group. That song was also penned by my uncle James Mitchell, but we called him Doom. Blame my head, not my heart, that I didn't see you guys when I made it the last trip back home. I love you guys.
So, and welcome back to Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. Special series here on the Mark Steiner Show with Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media's Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Detroit native. And on this portion of Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, we look at the history, what got us to where we are, and how we got to these place where these cities are in today. In the studio with us is Antero Pietola, who is an author of Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped an American City, and a 35-year veteran of the Sun, I think from Moscow to the police beat. Dr. Heather Ann Thompson, a professor of history at Temple University College of Liberal Arts, author of Who's Detroit? Politics, Labor, and Race in a Modern American City, and many other really fascinating articles she's done in the 60s and early 70s. And Dr. Heather Ann Thompson, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show.
Great to be here.
And soon we'll be joined by Dr. James Taylor, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of San Francisco, where he is Visiting Professor of African American Studies as well at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Black Nationalism in the United States. He hasn't joined us yet, but we'll be here in a minute. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner with your thoughts as we explore our new monthly series, Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. BDO to some, ODB to others.
I like ODB. I like ODB.
We can go ODB. That's fine. That's fine. But let's talk about the history of these places that we all lived in and are looking at as a kind of – we said in the very beginning of this program that you all didn't hear that all three of these cities in some ways are emblematic of the deindustrialization of America and of the power of how race and class define America can be seen to the lives of these cities. And Heather Ann Thompson, I'm going to start with you. Just your reflections on that.
Well, I think that that's absolutely the case, that all three of these cities were severely depressed as a result of things like deindustrialization. But I also think that in some respect, by looking at only the economics of the story, that is the industrialization story, we really miss the important political story that these three cities share, which is a long history of struggle for black empowerment in the cities and a long history of struggle against things like police brutality that played out in these particular cities with great white resistance, enormous or high levels, I should say, of white flight, and then a lot of chaos that was wrought by, reaction to black civil rights struggles that, while related to deindustrialization because it had to do with unemployment, was much more of a political story than I think people want to talk about, particularly people now talking about, say, bankruptcy in the city of Detroit.
Antero, how do you see that when you bring Baltimore to the story? I think it's similar.
Well, Baltimore kind of is an early pathfinder in some issues and a latecomer in many. For instance, during World War II, we had an influx of two population groups, outsiders. There were hillbillies and there were blacks from the Carolinas mostly. And hillbillies, after the war, they returned, many of them returned to the Virginias and Tennessee. And the black population continued to grow from the Carolinas. So what we have is Baltimore's population peaks in 1950. It's close to 1 million. And then white flight begins, but there's enough black movement into the city so that the population data shows that the city's population decline, drastic decline, starts only in the 1970s. So this is very interesting, and we really now are at a crossroads in the city in the sense that jobs clearly is a problem everywhere in urban settings. But I'll just give you three big employers in Baltimore, in Maryland, and you know what our problem is. Number one private employer is Johns Hopkins. State of Maryland is a big employer, and NSA. So you can see that ours is a very peculiar city in terms of employment.
Heather, I appreciated your book on Detroit for a number of different reasons. But one of the reasons I appreciated it is because you kind of flipped the narrative on its head, which talks about up until your book, I think the story about Detroit was that kind of the blacks had been given the city, right? Like, so white flight and then you have the election of somebody like Coleman Young, largely because of white flight. So blacks just kind of are given the city. But your work complicates that. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I think one of the previous understandings of Detroit was that we'd had an earlier deindustrialization than anyone had really realized, which is true. Deindustrialization really begins in the 50s, not in the 70s. But this notion that somehow the city was then emptied out, or that then, you know, black power becomes this inevitability, was not at all the case. The most interesting fights for equality in the city and a real balance of power in the city happened after the 60s and after 1967 in particular, when there was an upheaval that some call the Riot of 67. I would really characterize it as a rebellion for sort of greater equality in the city. And after that, there's a real contest for power. It's a contest between not just black and white Detroiters, or not against each other, because in fact there were white progressives that were also interested in humanizing the city. But what it comes down to was a mayoral election in 73 that the city was really cleaved in half over whether to elect a black mayor or whether to elect the former police commissioner, who had kind of had a notorious reputation in the city for undercover decoy operations in the black community. And when the police commissioner lost is when we see the most dramatic exodus of whites out of the city. And that's important, because with white flight went white tax base, white business interest, and frankly, the auto industry doesn't just leave Detroit for places like Mexico. The auto industry leaves Detroit for places like the Detroit suburbs, as did its workforce that was spending its tax dollars in the suburbs. So, you know, I always like to say Coleman Young, the first black mayor of the city, for all of his controversial reputation, he in many respects becomes the captain of a slowly sinking ship economically. And this is not because of inept black management. This is because literally the city's demographics change almost overnight after the election of a black mayor.
So I wonder what the two of you think and about all three of these cities and why what history tells about why they were all so different in terms of where they are now. You know, you have Oakland on the one hand, which is beginning to thrive in many ways, a really multiracial city where it's I think I've had this right, 26% of the population is black, 27% of the population is Latino, 27% of the population is white. 18% of the population is Asian. Mm-hmm. You have Detroit, which is almost all African American. Majority of the city is African American. People being pushed out. And Baltimore, which is majority African American, but increasingly white, with lots of deep poverty. What are the similarities and differences that brought these cities to the point where they are now? And what do they tell us about the future of urban America in the three different settings, do you think?
Well, let me start about Oakland. It's an interesting situation, because here is a city that became majority black, and now it has the black population has so suburbanized that the city is the black population at the most is one third.
Right.
And so the question is, when you ask about Oakland possibly beginning to thrive, is it easier for a city that does not have a black majority to attract outside investment, for instance? And that is a question that we can ask in Baltimore, because whatever we think about Mayor O'Malley, now governor, he was able to attract different type of investment and market Baltimore in a totally different way from any black mayor. So if this is racism in the investment community, so be it. But, I mean, I see it as a fact.
Interesting. That really is interesting. How would you pick up on that, Heather?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that's a very interesting observation. I mean, I guess what I would say is that in order to locate the real differences between these cities, you do have to go back to the economics. You have to go back to what is the main industry driving each area, and how dependent each area is on certain employers, and how dependent they are on businesses being within city limits, and other complex things like whether the city and the county are separate or the same thing. And there's a lot of complex urban political geography that answers why these cities are different. What I would actually like to call our attention to, though, is that even in Oakland and even in Baltimore, to the extent that there's been redevelopment, I actually think that the Detroit story is much more alarming and much more indicative of what urban America is about. And that is that for poor people and for people of color in these cities, whether it is Oakland, Baltimore, or Detroit, things have not gotten better, and in fact, things have gotten dramatically worse. In no small part, of course, because there's no jobs, because of the industrialization, but I also want to just put on the table, also because we have been fighting this major war on crime, quote-unquote, for 4 years in the same time period that these neighborhoods and cities collapsed. And frankly, for a city like Detroit or portions of Oakland or portions of Baltimore to ever be viable, to ever really recover, we have to deal with what's also happened in these cities, which is a massive blocking up of their populations. Dramatic increasing of sentencing, a dramatic increasing of drug policing, a dramatic increasing of incarceration. So then a city like Detroit, not only does it have a high unemployment rate, but it also has an almost permanently unemployable population because of felony convictions, because of incarceration. And that same story plays out in Oakland, in Baltimore, in parts of Cleveland, in parts of New York. That's the urban story that I think we really need to start dealing with, the connection between the lack of jobs and also this massive carceral infrastructure we've built and really implemented in these cities.
This brings to mind, in an interesting way, the role of the federal government. So we know what populations were fleeing. We know the politics that the populations in the Great Migration were fleeing. But what's kind of under-examined is the role of the federal government in creating the conditions for the cities, for Baltimore, Detroit, and Oakland to thrive, and then on the flip side to actually fail in some ways. Could you talk about that?
Can I just say, to keep this sort of idea alive about how, the economics are important, but so are the politics, and so are these shifting ideas about incarceration. Bear in mind that at the very same moment that President Lyndon Johnson is passing the civil rights laws to make it possible, more possible for African Americans to vote, this is when he also passes the Law Enforcement Administration Act, which infuses cities like Detroit and Baltimore and Oakland with massive capital to police their urban neighborhoods in new ways. And this is why the federal government, on the one hand, gives with the civil rights hand, but also takes away with policing, takes away with urban redevelopment funds and so forth. So, yeah, I think the feds are a big part of the story, as, by the way, is state government. I mean, you can't understand Michigan's story without really understanding the way that Michigan, as a state, begins to take power from the city of Detroit and redistribute it to the suburbs. And I don't know the Baltimore story as well, or Oakland, but my guess is it's a similar story.
Well, Baltimore has been blessed in a way that so many of recent governors have been Baltimore oriented people, but that situation is changing. Now, you have to also understand another thing about Baltimore, that of all these three cities, Baltimore is the last one in which blacks gain the mayor's office.
Right.
There's a dozen-year difference between Detroit and Oakland and Baltimore, and you also have to remember that it did not happen at the ballot box. It happened because Drew Burns was the city council president who succeeded William Donald Schaefer, who was a very big mayor. And so these are very interesting comparisons, and I thank you, Mark, for opening this conversation, because this is a very important one.
I wonder, again, when you look at this, I mean, you said a couple of things here. One is about the police and the role the police departments have played in these cities and how that affects what these cities are. Let me just stop there, because I think that's you. Because all these police departments, Oakland, Detroit, and Baltimore, have had huge criticisms in terms of its relationship to the communities of color and the power it uses to enforce the law in communities. In every city, I've looked at the newspaper even still today, whether it's Oakland's the Tribune of Oakland. Oakland reading that paper the other night, you know, online, or Detroit's papers or Baltimore's papers all these last couple of weeks. They're full of stories about communities rising up because they are feeling attacked.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that is a really, really real part of all these urban centers. Heather?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And that's exactly why we get black mayors in many of these cities, because there is such a desire to shift power, to believe that a black mayor will reign differently than a white mayor and perhaps root out the problem of police brutality. But yeah, I think that's what I meant when I said, I think if we're really going to understand what's happening to America's cities, we have to look at the economics and we have to look at where resources go. But we really also have to look at the intimate politics on the street, how communities are viewed, how they're policed, how they're schooled. I mean, you know, in Detroit, we say, what in the world happened to Detroit? But then we look at something like the Detroit school system, and we get a new perspective on what happened to Detroit. I mean, you know, consider that in 2009, you know, almost 25,000 young people, get arrested, even though only, you know, less than 4% of them are for aggravated assault. So we're policing these cities in new ways. And when you do that, you erode them. You tear them down. You don't tear down the rich white people's communities, because you're not policing those. You don't tear down even in some of these cases, the downtown area where a lot of capital will still remain or will come in. But you tear down the neighborhoods, you tear down the communities, and then it makes it very difficult to invite more industry in and to imagine rebuilding these cities. So I think it is the untold story. It's what we really need to start thinking about when we think about, you know, urban renewal and building up cities again.
Well, it could be argued that the police department in Baltimore for a long time was trying to keep the political order. Whites were in control at City Hall. The police department had a commissioner who was a defining commissioner, just like Mayor Schaefer a couple of years later would be a defining mayor. The defining police commissioner was Donald Pomerleau, who was seen by wide segments of the black community as the enemy. The police department was seen as the enemy. I just looked at a news story from lots of years back after the riots. More than 100 black leaders of all backgrounds united to demand that Pomerleau be fired. Nothing happened.
Right. No.
And we look at the Pomerleau time, if you ask a regular Baltimorean, if they remember Pomerleau at all, it is seen as a good time for policing by many.
It was, when Pomerleau was commissioner, it was the last time I was arrested.
So one of the things that strikes, when I think about Baltimore and Detroit and Oakland up in the contemporary moment, I think about population changes, but I also think about the attempts of the mayors in these three places to deal with urban disinvestment. And here, the role of downtown development becomes really seminal, right? So I think about Detroit and actually, as I think about the name of it, what the original name of the Beacon, the economic symbol of Detroit, is the Renaissance Center, or was the Renaissance Center.
Right.
Or I think about the Inner Harbor in Baltimore. I was wondering if you guys could talk about the role downtown development plays in the contemporary moment in those three places.
Critical.
Well, in Baltimore, what we are witnessing is a very, very historic turning point. Baltimore was started on the waterfront in Fells Point, Jonestown, on the east side. And now downtown is moving back to the east side from the west side. And this is the background to a huge political battle over money, a battle that features Padorakis on one side and Peter Angelos on the other side. And so these are interesting things. Now the other thing that happens tragically at the same time is the possible ascendancy of Owings Mills as an alternative to downtown Baltimore. When T. Rowe Price is unhappy about being at the Inner Harbor and is thinking about going to Harbor East or Harbor Point, it has an alternative. It can move to Owings Mills in Baltimore County and leave the city behind. And, Mark, you made the statement earlier that Baltimore has stabilized the population flow. Well, the fact is there may be some whites moving to Baltimore, but black middle class is still screaming out, taking away with it its institutions. This is very important.
Right. Moving to suburbs like Pikesville and Randallstown and northeastern Baltimore County,
oh, wow.
Both. Ruth Ann?
Heather.
Heather Ann, excuse me.
I think that the issue of how you develop cities and whether the downtown investment model is the right one is under a lot of scrutiny. I mean, historically, it's a problematic model because, one of the things in Detroit that Mayor Young gets criticized for most harshly, I think, is this idea that he only wanted to build up the downtown. He wanted to build the Renaissance Center and build up the downtown really at the expense of neighborhoods. On the other hand, we get the argument that some of our most successful comeback stories have been about building the downtown, getting folks back downtown, getting them to the restaurants, getting them to the theaters. I think that the problem is, again, unless we deal with the neighborhoods, we don't bring the population back in any real numbers. We don't really bring back urban infrastructure. And, you know, a glitzy theater and some fancy restaurants do not sustain cities. We need real schooling, real education, real employment. One of the most striking things about Detroit, if you visit there, is that it is literally possible to do anything that you used to do in the city of Detroit now outside of the city of Detroit. Entertainment, doctor's visits, education, any possible service that the city of Detroit provided can now be found outside of the city. So the question then becomes, why would people go back into the city? And sure, they might go if there was some great thing downtown to see or to do, you know, go to a Tiger game, if the Pistons come home, come downtown to see the Pistons. But that doesn't mean they have to live there, right? They don't have to live there. And they won't live there, black or white, if the school system remains collapsed, if there are no jobs, if the trash can't get picked up, and so forth.
I think that's an excellent way to kind of end the segment. I mean, one of the questions that we're going to be dealing with going forward is what exactly should a city do? So we think about cities primarily as economic units, but you're so right to bring, both of you guys are so right to bring in the politics and to bring in the fact that these cities are supposed to at some way deal up, they're supposed to be humane. So one of the questions we're going to be dealing with going forward is how do we create the political conditions where cities like these and then other cities in general can be more humane to its residents.
I do want to thank Dr. Heather Ann Thompson, professor of history at Temple University College of Liberal Arts, author of the book Who's Detroit? Politics, Labor, and Race in a Modern American City, and Anthro Pietola, author of Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City. Thank you both so much, and we'll have you back as we continue Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland.
Great discussion. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to go to break, and as you go out, we're going to hear Nina Simone, Oh, Baltimore.
And the people hide their faces, and they hide their eyes. Because the city's dying, and they don't.
Where I take my stand, take my stick and draw a line in the sand, show my hand, initiate the actions plan. Now give me time for a start to give me back my plans. The salt water drips from my oculus. I got the urge to just squeeze on the Glock and burst. My fingertips wipe away my teardrops, a curse. You digging in my purse, so may you rock a hearse. This feeling's popular, cause people's kids need socks and shirts. And if you pull, you get whopped the worst. Hope to Hollywood endings without plot.
Cool, the stand. We had to jump by that song soon before we got fined for the words that come next. Listen, here's the Mark Steiner Show, and on our segment, Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. that was created out of the mind of Dr. Lester Spence, who's a co-host here for this series, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence and Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, a Detroit native. And on a way to this conversation, I have to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. For more information, www.mecu.com. And I have to remind you that WEAA, support for WEAA, is provided in part by Think About Your Eyes. More information available at thinkaboutyoureyes.com. So we are going to begin this segment talking with activists from three cities about what we've gone through, our history of migration earlier with Isabel Wilkerson, and now looking at where we go from here. Where do cities go from here, these three cities, Baltimore, Detroit, and Oakland? We are joined here in studio by Betty Robinson, longtime Baltimore resident and community organizer, co-editor of Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts of Women in SNCC, and joining us by phone. My sheets are too many sheets. Here we go. I got it. Dream Hampton, once again, great to have her back with us. Cultural critic, writer, filmmaker, feminist, co-author with Jay-Z and the New York Times bestseller Decoded, and Adriana Clay, who is associate professor of sociology and research faculty at the Center for Research and Education on Gender and Sexuality at San Francisco State, author of The Hip-Hop Generation Fights Back, Youth Activism, and Post-Civil Rights Politics, and blogs at queerblackfeminist.blogspot.com. And everybody, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
What up, Doe?
You want to jump off on this one, Lester Stirr?
So the first segment was about we wanted to kind of trace the history of the migration of black populations primarily as it affects the history of the Rust Belt and the histories of Detroit, Baltimore, and Oakland. Then the last segment, we wanted to talk about kind of the post-industrial or the industrial and post-industrial history of these spaces. Now what we want to do is kind of talk about resistance and what activism has looked like and what it actually does look like in these three cities. So I guess the first question for our guests is, could you talk a little bit about the activist histories of these three cities? You're going to either focus on your specific city, you know, Dream, I know you represent Detroit, or you could just talk about the things that bring these cities together.
Well, we start with Dream. Why don't you jump into it, yeah. Dream?
Oh, well, the activist history is so rich. I mean, watching the March on Washington celebrate its 50th year anniversary, there were nods to people like Walter Reuther and some of the labor organizers. But, of course, I'm always reminded, given that we just spent Labor Day, I always tweet out James Boggs' handbook. What's the title, Lester? Don't let me mess it up. The American Negro...
What, the New American Revolution?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Well, both of them, the Workers' Handbook and the New American Revolution by James Boggs. So we have this rich history of labor activism that affected the entire world and made it possible for high school degree or less having hardworking people to enter the middle class. And that is absolutely my city's historic kind of contribution to the country. I actually and absolutely experienced that firsthand in my own family. And we also have very, and it'll probably derail the conversation, but we've got all these other kind of interesting black nationalist movements that, of course, come out of Detroit, not the least of which is, of course, the Nation of Islam. But when I think of the Nation of Islam, I think about some of the early kind of intervention work they were doing in neighborhoods that even police had given up on when it came to the height of the era that I grew up in the mid-'80s, with the activism against the drug violence, the violence that was a result of the billion-dollar crack industry. Right now, I'm seeing a pushback. When I think about, I mean, what's often said about Detroit is the thousands of urban farms that we have. Detroit has, in so many ways, become ground zero in shaping the conversation around the food justice movement. And that's a direct result of fighting, well, actually creating something, not even fighting and pushing back, but creating, nurturing spaces in the
presence of corporate boycotts, you know, Kroger, the grocery store that surrounds the Detroit area. We didn't boycott them. They boycotted the city. And we just came up with creative solutions, and we continue to do that. We continue to turn scarcity into innovation. And I think that will, if it's not been Detroit's legacy, it will certainly be going forward.
Adriana Clay.
Yeah, I think Oakland has a long history of activism as well. And I think, I mean, recently Oakland has gotten some attention around Occupy Oakland. There was like the article about the sort of last city of activism focused specifically on Occupy Oakland, which built on decades of activism in the city, but also simultaneously ignored the activism. And I think there's ongoing grassroots organizing happening specifically around police brutality and targeting of particularly young African-American youth and young people of color by organizations like the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and Just Cause. But also, I think people mostly remember the activism in Oakland as being centered around the Black Power movement, specifically the Black Panthers, and also the student organizing that developed the ethnic studies in the Bay Area, but also throughout the country, not to mention like the activism of the longshoremen. So it has a rich history of activism in the Chicano movement that really still fuels the city.
So, Betty, from Baltimore perspective.
Okay, so I came to Baltimore in 1972. I think a little background is important. I had been involved in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement in the 60s, and I came here as part of a wave of young people. I guess we were close to our 30s then, but a wave of young people around the country who came to industrial cities to work in factories. And the idea was that during the civil rights and the anti-war movement, especially the anti-war movement, the picture was of working class folks being in favor of continuing the war in Vietnam because they were their jobs were tied to the armaments industry. So it was pretty clear that if we were really going to change the institutions of the country, we had to work in the factories. And 10,000 of us did that all across the country. Now, of course, many of us entered factories in cities where factories were leaving. In fact, in reflection, you look at the factories start leaving Baltimore in the 50s and the 60s, although we don't know that in retrospect. We learn that in retrospect when you learn about the Federal Highway Act, creating the opportunity for goods to travel across highways. And all of these things have also a race aspect, a structural racism aspect built into them. But anyway, back to the organizing in Baltimore, I can kind of tick off a whole set of things that happened. Well, one thing I want to just mention is there the white left community and the black left, black progressive community have very often been as separate as the black and white communities in the city. And I wish I had thought this, I had thought about this more and fleshed it out a little bit before the program. But hearing the conversation, it made me remember that when I got my OSI fellowship in 2003 and I set about to interview organizers and activists from the 60s to the 90s, because I wanted to interview people who were living, I learned that there were these two separate activist/organizing communities. So, but some of the things that do you want me to continue? I don't want to be of the things that have. I mean, Baltimore in the 60s was very much characterized by the civil rights movement. There was a lot of work desegregating facilities. We were a southern city. The only place in 1960 that you could meet somebody of another race for coffee was at the train station. So civil
left
rights.
Jazz Society.
Pardon?
Or the Left Bank Jazz Society.
Oh, maybe the Jazz Society, right, which that's another aspect you should go into as the cultural.
So but I'd like to kind of push the thing in terms of what you all think it means now.
Okay.
What it means for the 21st century. When you look at the history of activism, and like in Baltimore, I knew that was really built and was not, unlike other cities, it wasn't a student-based movement that built this in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
It was in the working-class black and white communities where the movement was created and where it came from, which is very different than some other places during the late 60s and early 70s. But I'm curious where you think it goes now. All these three cities are very different in terms of who lives within them. Their racial interaction in those cities. And I'm very curious where you think differently or similarly they will be going. What activists have to say about where it's going to go in the 21st century? Dream?
Detroit is the home of, the kind of redlining around real estate and housing segregation. I mean, it's ground zero for that. Like, neighborhood watches that would welcome black neighbors who moved into suburban or even not integrated communities with fire bombs and all kinds of things was absolutely Detroit's kind of legacy in terms of representing that blatant racism and terrorism in the North. And right now we're witnessing the grandchildren, basically, of Michigan suburbanites who fled in the early 70s or the late 60s, depending on when they could afford to, who fled the city and told their children and their grandchildren that if they came to the city, they'd be murdered or raped. And they, too, boycotted the city economically. They divested from the city and set up kind of outposts around the city, creating a donut with an empty, center, particularly after kind of a lot of black political and economic capital was squandered, and also, just the devastation of Reaganomics. And so now we're dealing with holding on to what we were proud to say we owned, which are the homes, the land. We're dealing with a gentrification that's not called gentrification because so much of Detroit is devastated. And so people come in with a blank canvas kind of, mindset when they occupy these neighborhoods, take them over, get great media for being at the center of the revitalization of Detroit, and black and native Detroiters are completely displaced in that story, in that narrative. And in fact, and in reality, as we look at attempts to downsize the city, as we look at land grabs, as we had with a recent, few acres of a parcel that the city owned and sold to a very rich white suburban banker, even as many in the city came out to protest. So we're really looking, often when we talk about African-American struggle, it's a cerebral one. It's one of ideas and rights. But in Detroit, it's always been one that you could actually point to a map and show the boundaries of this struggle. And that's what we're fighting for right now, is housing and land, our very right to vote and have our votes mean something. Our entire city government was dissolved from Lansing, from the state capital, by the Tea Party governor that we have up there. So it's an interesting struggle, and it's going to require a lot of perseverance.
Adriana.
I think Oakland is interesting, and I mostly have my eye on and have worked with young people. And I think the thing that's really interesting about Oakland and great about Oakland is that the young people and the organizing now really builds on the history of organizing that's happened here. And something unique about it is sort of the multiracial, both unique and also what gets sort of thought about in Oakland as unique, is the multiracial organizing that happens. And that does actually happen on the ground, like multiracial organizing around issues that often specifically target African Americans a lot of the times, not only, but it's a multiracial base, and it sort of builds on that history. So the diversity, quote unquote, of Oakland that's celebrated really does come through in the things that people organize around a lot of the times. And then just recently, two things that I think are going to shape the future of Oakland is that it's also, in the last decade or maybe the last 15 years, really been recognized as sort of a city where LGBT families and LGBT folks have settled in. And a lot of that has happened in the gentrification of neighborhoods, although they've been longtime residents, gentrification of neighborhoods that were predominantly Black and working class, like Maxwell Park. And some of the same tensions remain, although it's celebrated as a diversity on many levels now, the multiracial, the LGBT, you know, sort of moving out of San Francisco. Some of the same tensions remain around surveillance, particularly of young Black bodies, as those sort of tensions, like as those communities sort of bump up against each other. So that's one thing I think hopefully will shape the future of organizing, like those communities coming together more. And it's not that they're necessarily separate, but that's just sort of where I see some push-pull, especially with the visibility of LGBT communities in recent years. And you can kind of see that in Mayor Gene Kwan's recent statements on the defeat of DOMA, at the same time that she enforces gang injunctions that specifically target youth and has, you know, notoriously sat back in terms of the Oakland Police Department and her support there. And also, in the last year, Oakland has really been affected by the second tech boom in San Francisco, where now San Franciscans that could stay in the city for a long time can no longer stay in the city. And these are mostly white San Franciscans moving into Oakland and really changing the landscape of Oakland, because Oakland's had a long white and working or middle class and working class white population, but this population of sort of Google and Facebook and Yahoo is quickly changing the landscape in some of these neighborhoods where people didn't move. I mean, the LGBT community maybe moved in, and that's where LGBT people of color moved into these communities. But now we see white folks from this population, a younger population in particular, really changing the landscape of the city, changing the organizing of the city, changing the values of the city.
Dream mentioned James Boggs' work, and it's the American Revolution earlier. One of the pieces that he wrote that struck me was the city is the Black man's land, one of the first treaties on Black power. In fact, Grace delivered that paper here in Baltimore at Morgan State University, where WEA is cited. Although Detroit, as Dream noted, their government's more or less been dissolved. All the figures are all the elected officials are figureheads. Both Oakland and Baltimore have Black mayors. They both have have non-white mayors, uh-huh. Non-white female mayors. Oakland with Gene Kwan, Baltimore is definitely Rawlings Blake. How has the presence of Black of non-white political power affected the activist dynamics in these cities?
Okay. Now I'm going to try to answer both questions. The earlier one, just I want to make a comment that I think it's really critical as we look at organizing for today to study the history of social movements in the country and look at what happened with them. And going to the March on Washington, the 50th anniversary, made me even reflect more on this, that the civil rights movement, which had a big vision, the system seemed to adapt and incorporated the most dominant demands, and then was able to shuffle those demands back into the work of the system and continue for 50 years to do what it had always done. So I just would say let's study our history as we organize. But in terms of Baltimore today, there's been a lot of work going on invisible, basically. But the two most promising or the three most promising things that are happening is, one, there's all this vibrant youth development work around the school-to-prison pipeline, around youth, the voice of youth being considered and heard, youth leadership development, and so on. I think that's really promising, and I think it's going to really propel us forward. There's the Fair Development Coalition, which I think is a fabulous development because it's really begun the conversation about, okay, are we gentrifying the city? Are we bringing outsiders in? How are we creating jobs for the people who live here? Are we paying attention to the 8,000 returning citizens who come from prison every year who are going to need a place in our city? Are we thinking about their future and how will the city actually thrive if we don't think about the young people coming out of school and those people returning citizens as well? There are food justice and environmental motions, so there's that. There's new organizing among workers, which I think is very promising. Hotel workers, the Hyatt as a main example, the hospital workers, University of Maryland Medical System. There's a lot of other under the ground, invisible work that's going on. So I'm really hopeful about Baltimore.
We have like 5 minutes left on our segment, so I'm going to try to get to the closing part of what we're talking about here and what you were kind of raising. And I wondered if at this point in cities, whether it makes a difference that there's a mayor that's a woman or a woman of color or a person of color at all. Dream and then Andriana? Dream?
I mean, in Detroit, we've always been dealing with class issues and conservatism versus neoliberalism in some cases when it comes to our black leadership, at least the elected ones. I mean, I'm sure that Lester could speak to this. I know we only have 5 minutes left, but Coleman Young's legacy is a very mixed bag,
yep.
You know, particularly near the end of his. I mean, I would call our current mayor a neoliberal, but I don't even know that he would know, you know, have the intellectual kind of capacity to go by that way.
Yeah, real talk. Right.
I mean, he's just kind of conceited. He's kind of come in with you know, this paternalistic anything. And we just really wanted to elect someone older after Kwame. It really just came down to that. You know, but the black leadership in Detroit has always been strong outside of the elected officials, too. There was a point when grassroots activists and organizers could really push the electoral to the left, and that has ceased to be, and that frightens me.
Yeah.
There is the kind of chaos and crisis and scarcity talk that has everyone moving into this neoliberalism, which is shocking coming from such a radical city like Detroit. But on the ground, I'd say that it remains as radical and creative and innovative as ever.
Andriana?
I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, Gene Kwan is the current mayor, and I don't see that in terms of as a city of color or on the part of working class and poor people of color that much has changed. In fact, sort of the lack of accountability by the Oakland PD and the amount of surveillance and brutality on the part of Oakland PD, which he came under fire for Occupy Oakland, has remained the same and in some cases increase. And then before Gene Kwan was Ron Dellums, who was actually, you know, a petition was garnered to put Dellums into office when there wasn't a black candidate for mayor. And I don't know that his role as mayor, his term as mayor, changed that much in terms of the city either. So I wouldn't say that it doesn't make a difference, but it hasn't in terms of these last two mayors that we've had. But this has been Oakland's experience for the last decade. You know, people kind of excitedly brought Jerry Brown in at the beginning of the 21st century, thinking he was going to bring some of that, you know, his role as governor in the 70s back with him, but since then Oakland's really been focused on this movement towards development of the city and development in the ways that you were talking about in the previous segment about attracting a particular population and a particular view of the city that really erases, you know, what the city is known for.
We have to take a break here, but I do would appreciate all of our guests here, and we'll have them back as we look at the future of cities and activism of the Roundtable of Activists here on Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, our monthly series, which is the brainchild of our co-host, Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media's Media Scholar in Residence, also Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. So this is a great new series we're doing. I want to thank Dream Hampton, Andriana Clay, and Betty Robinson for joining us in the segment. It's great to have all three of you with us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Always great to have you all with us. This is good. And we will be doing this again next month with a new segment of Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland. And keep this conversation alive and bring people together from all three cities to make this conversation happen nationally. So thank you all for being with us. This has been great.
Thank you. Thank you.
On our way out the door, I have to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. And reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Enery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. You can podcast the show, and find out about our guests, the books they've written, what they're doing, by visiting us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and podcast our stuff now on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Dedicated Adela Poop, Abel Miracle, Fannie Lou Hamer, Marla Ricks, Nina, and Fred Hampton. Yeah. There goes a neighborhood like Fred Sanford next door to Ned Flanders. These cats pop off at the mouth like over Redenbacher. My lyrics open up the porter.